Great. Thank you, Steve. This is Angela Hedon. I'll be chairing the meeting today and wanted to welcome everybody who's online as well as everybody who's here with us today. And I'm sure everyone's just probably playing a little catch up if you took some time off last week, like most of us. So we'll go ahead and get started. And I think the first item that we have, as we do every meeting, we have our 3-minute public comment time period. And I don't know if anybody here today would like to share any information with us. Doesn't look like it. So we'll go ahead and move on to the new election rules. And I don't know if we were having someone specifically.
Is this working? Steve, is this picking up?
Yeah, that's on.
Okay. So at the last meeting, we scheduled a presentation on the election rules. And so I invited today Troy Bratton. He's our manager of legal and policy here at the secretary's office. Sorry, what? Oh, and he's telling me that Hillary Rudy, who's our deputy director of elections, will also be here. Troy has been with the office for about 2 years. Prior to that, he was a drafter in the legislature and worked on Title I, so we feel really fortunate to have him looking through this and coming up with a comprehensive set of rules for us. And I think in a minute he'll be joined by Hillary.
Great. Thank you, Suzanne. And so, Troy, why don't you go ahead and start it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just go ahead and get started until Hillary gets here. We are going through some rules for elections after the passage of 1303. They're pretty comprehensive, and we're not quite through with the process yet ourselves, so this will be a pretty general overview. There's a document in your packet titled Proposed Rules to Address Conflicts and Ambiguities in Title I after 1303. So this just points out some of the issues we've come across and how we propose fixing them by rule, if we can. Don't always have a solution just yet. So I can just start going through these, and if the commissioners have any questions, feel free to stop me and ask me. So the first subset here is voter registration and election day registration, and I think you guys touched on this issue last week. It's basically the need for nightly database updates from CDOR, CDOC, and CDPHE. As you heard last week, we are working on MOAs with those agencies, but have hit a couple snags, but hopefully we'll be able to address those problems through the MOAs or through rulemaking later if there's a way we can figure out to do that. The next deck issue, if an elector registers to vote between 21 and 7 days before the election, that elector won't receive a ballot by mail because ballots go out 22 to 18 days before the election. And we suspect that an elector might expect a ballot by mail having registered within that time frame. So our proposed solution is just to promulgate a rule to have the county clerk and recorder notify those electors that they are registered for that election, but they may not receive a mail ballot, and that if they want to vote in the upcoming election, they'll need to go to a clerk's office or a voter service and polling center.
Looks like there's a question.
Go right ahead. So, Troy, in existing statute, there's a provision that allows electors to request a mail-in ballot up through the 7th day before. Given that, have you thought about adopting a rule that would allow county clerks and recorders to send out the ballots through the 7th day and then after that direct the voter to a voter service and polling center or issue the ballot there on the spot?
Sure, that's certainly a solution.
Great.
Same question.
Next, the bill requires municipalities and special districts to offer election day registration, but municipalities and special districts don't have access to SCORE. So what we're trying to figure out is how counties would provide that for municipalities and special districts. What we are thinking is a rule that would allow an elector of a special district or a municipality to go to the county clerk's office and request or register and then get a certificate of registration that they could then take back to the county or the municipality or special district. D DEO. Because some special districts and municipalities have territory in more than one county, it seems like any county that has territory from a special district or municipality would have to provide that election day registration. And one of the problems we're trying to address there is if the special district is not near the county seat or near a clerk's office, how an elector could do that, but that's something we have yet to really be able to iron out. Next, the residency requirement in 1303 was changed from 30 days to 22 days, but it remained 30 days for municipals in Title 31 and special districts in Title 32. So if an election is coordinated, there's different eligibility. I mean, somebody may be eligible to vote in the county election, but not in the municipal election. So the only solution we've been able to come up thus far is to have a county print separate ballots for the county, any municipality, and then any special district that's being coordinated. And an elector may have to vote more than one ballot, may have to vote several ballots. But because the eligibility deadlines are different, we don't see a way that a county could only have one ballot for everybody in the county, or for everybody in those political subdivisions. So, continuing with voter registration issues, the bill required still, even though there's election day registration, the bill still requires 29 days of party affiliation to vote in a primary election. So if a voter showed up to register on election day for a primary election and declared affiliation with a party, they wouldn't be eligible to vote in that primary election because they haven't been affiliated for 29 days. So we're not quite sure how to fix that. Possibly a rule that requires whoever is registering that voter to register them as unaffiliated and then change the affiliation that day so that voter can vote in the primary. But it's a weird workaround. But right now there's no way for somebody to show up, register on election day for a primary election, and then vote in that election. So another section of the bill requires clerks to offer registration at a voter service and polling place 15 days before the election. But voter service and polling centers are only open for 15 days before an election and a general election. So there's no way for a clerk to allow somebody to register to vote for 15 days in another election at a service center because they're open for 8 days. So we'll probably just promulgate a rule there saying that clerks must offer registration at the voter service and polling centers during the time that the centers are open. What's this last one? Oh, so if a voter shows up or an applicant shows up, sure.
Sorry. I'm looking at the law and I see the part of the statute that you're looking at where it says during the 21 days when the voter service and polling center is open. But then there's another provision that I think it's page 20. I'm not sure because my pages are out of order about what the citation is, that says that you only have to offer it at the voter service and polling center when the voter service and polling center is open. So it seems like the statute provides for that. So is that where you think, is that why you're thinking that the
rule
would just
be along?
That's
the conflict, yes.
Okay.
Right now, if a voter were to show up and register at a voter service and polling center without ID, they couldn't vote in person because they don't have ID, but they would be allowed to leave with a mail ballot and then return that mail ballot without an ID, because right now the law only requires ID be returned with a mail ballot if the person registered by mail. So that means a person could return a mail ballot without showing ID, in which case they voted without ID. Haven't come up with a solution for that yet. There seems to be a double standard there for registering by mail or registering in person.
How is that handled? I mean, maybe this is a question for Hillary or Amber or somebody, but what's the current practice? I mean, if someone under the current, or pre-1303, I guess, went into a clerk's office or registered to vote in person, they could register without ID and then also get a mail ballot. So is there a process to handle that under the current law?
Or register is it an existing... Without-
Well, how would, is, I guess the question is, how is it different under 1303, except that it all happens at one time? Because if you went into a clerk's office, you could register to vote could request a mail ballot, right?
The requiring ID is for registering by mail. And then if you didn't show it when you registered by mail, then it needs to come back with your mail ballot.
Right.
If it doesn't, you'd be ID deficient.
You're correct, Elena. Currently, if someone comes into our office and registers in person, they don't have ID, that they would still be registered.
And they would still be able to vote a mail ballot without showing additional ID.
Correct.
So that's a current...
Registered and this is no different. It's just that they happen at the same time. It's an existing issue.
Okay. Thank you.
But the weird thing here is that person couldn't vote, would have to vote provisional in the polling place, but could walk out with a mail ballot and never show ID.
Right, so it would be the same treatment for in-person voting, but for mail ballot, mm-hmm. it would be the same as it is under current law, where if they took mm-hmm. the mail ballot with them, they wouldn't be required to show additional ID.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Establishing voter service and polling centers. So this is an issue that came up recently. The bill states that all recall elections must be by mail ballot, but all mail ballot elections must have voter service and polling centers and drop-off locations. And there's only one formula for establishing voter service and polling centers and drop-off locations. So if there's a small special district in a county that's having a recall election or a municipal recall election, that election has to be by mail ballot. And that mail ballot election has to have the full complement of voter service and polling centers, which is one for 30,000 voters in the county, regardless of the size of the special district. So if the special district tries to run this election, they're going to have to do all those voter service and polling centers, which would have to have all the services that a voter service and polling center must have. They'd be forced to coordinate with the county clerk because they're just not going to be able to do that. But coordinating with the county clerk would come with some significant expenses. We don't have a solution for this now, but we're looking at we're talking with special districts, municipalities, and counties who look to be affected by this in the future to try to come up with some kind of rule. The problem with the rule here, though, is it's necessarily going to conflict the law, so it may not make it past the AG or the legislature, even if we did try to do it. Another issue, the definition of drop-off boxes in the definition section excludes mailboxes maintained at service centers, but later in the bill, it says you can have standalone drop-off locations, except for a 24-hour secure drop-off location can be at a voter service and polling center. So that's the reading we're taking of it. It's kind of confusing, but it sounds like a county needs to have standalone drop-off locations unless the location is under 24-hour surveillance, and then it can be at the service center. But it doesn't seem like they could all be at service centers. I don't think a county could put all their drop-off locations at a service center just by having 24-hour surveillance. So we're looking into that, probably try to promulgate a rule putting a cap on that. Also, for general elections, the bill says voter service and polling centers must be open for 15 days before the election. There is no timetable for drop-off locations, so we just probably promulgate a rule saying that those drop-off locations must be available the same days as voter service and polling centers. The bill requires drop-off locations to receive ballots.
I'm sorry, I have a bad question.
Sure.
So are you reading drop-off location and standalone drop-off location to be two distinct terms with different requirements, or are they interchangeable as you're interpreting the law?
I think we're going to interpreted as being interchangeable along with the 24-hour secure drop boxes, but they're different terms used in the statute. And typically when the legislature uses different terms, they do it on purpose and each has a specific meaning, but we see no other way to read those.
Because the reason I was asking is there's a time frame for the standalone drop-off locations for general elections that's more narrow than the reading that your office is taking, and I wasn't sure if that was intended.
Where in?
It's page 38. It's the end of section 31 of the bill. And it's
What statutory section?
Let's go back. It's B2, but then I got to go back a few pages to find what comes before that. Sorry. It'll be a little out of order. I'm happy to look it up while we keep going and just.
It sounds like you might be talking about the time period for Tier 1 counties that says at minimum 3 days before the election.
Right.
So, but that's only for those counties. And it could be read as a county needs to only have them for those 3 days.
Voter
is that the intent?
Centers.
The voter service centers address what is required, that the drop-off is required at a voter service center and polling location. And that's the drop-off.
Voter service centers address.
As part of the description of what's required at those, it's required that you have drop-off at those locations, and
right.
That covers that part. That the intent was for that to cover that part of it, with the additional standalone drop-offs to be additional locations, depending on whether
that are only open 3 days before the election.
Correct.
For Tier 1 counties?
For Tier 1 counties, all other counties are not required additional drop-off locations. They're
okay.
Required to be part of their voter service center. And I appreciate you pointing out how that may not be clear.
Yeah, there were no timetables. So that's, if that was the interpretation, I mean, maybe
I would say
that
there are no timetables may not be quite accurate. I think that it's...
But there's nothing that says when they're open for Tier 2 counties.
It talks about it as part of the voter service polling center, and there is a clear timetable for
those. But
the
term drop-off location specifically excludes mailboxes at voter service and polling centers.
I'll review it and ask you more questions later then. Thanks.
The next issue, the bill requires drop-off locations to receive ballots during reasonable business hours. Several counties have called and emailed us recently asking what reasonable business hours mean. Some use school district offices, some use municipal clerks to help them with that. So we'll probably just promulgate a rule defining what we think reasonable business hours are, especially for Saturdays when there aren't reasonable business hours, but some of these are required to be open.
And is there any guidance from the primary mail ballot formula, which uses the same language? Was there a rule at that time, or have counties come up with practice, or is that just an existing confusion around that term?
Because the
primary mail ballot statute uses that similar phrase, reasonable business hours, for the mail ballot drop-off,
sure.
So I wasn't sure if that was something that had been addressed in previous rules.
Sure.
Okay.
You know, I don't believe that we put a specific time frame in the mail ballot plan for the primary mail ballot plan. I think what's more challenging is that the primary mail ballot was once every 2 years, and now we're looking at doing reasonable business hours for a lot of Saturdays over many more elections. And so I think that where in the past counties who had the option of potentially canceling a primary if they had no contested elections, maybe we're a little less concerned about, you know, being consistent and using similar reasonable business hours. Now they're looking at the mail ballot for November. This is the first time in a coordinated year they've had to have these offices open on a Saturday, and so they want to make sure they're right in terms of what reasonable business hours are for this coming election in November. This is new to them in November.
And I'm sorry, this is somewhat unrelated to the rules, but is that going to be part then of the mail ballot plan? They'll say what their reasonable business hours are for each location, or is that up to the counties to include or not as they see?
Anything that's covered in the statute or rules in terms of a requirement will also be covered in the mail ballot plan.
Great. Thank you.
The next section is election judges and watchers. There's concern from counties about election judges having access to score registering voters and score, so we just propose a rule that it has to be a county clerk employee, either a temporary or permanent employee, that registers electors, and then that person also go through some training.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I guess you partially answered the question. They can be temporary employees, but I think we're all concerned about training. And what's our feeling? Do the counties have enough employees to staff the centers that they're required to have open?
That might be a county clerk question.
With our full-time employees, we do not have enough to staff. We've used temporary employees currently to register voters as well, and they do receive much more training than current Election Day judge training.
So we believe that temporary employees could be hired to the, and the numbers required to have one at every voting center?
Absolutely.
Okay.
As Clerk Hall said, it's pretty common practice, particularly in general elections, to hire temporary staff.
Go ahead, Troy.
Back to the judges and watchers section. A section of the bill requires clerks to have one supervisor judge per precinct. We think that might have just been an oversight in the bill, because that would require hundreds of supervising judges for counties. And we think the intent was just one supervising judge at each voter service and polling center. But so we may promulgate a rule trying to clarify that. But again, that rule would directly contravene the statute. So I'm not so sure how successful we'll be in that. Along those same lines, for partisan elections, the bill says that major parties are entitled to half of the appointed supervisor judges. But we have three major parties, so they can't each have half. So thinking about a rule that would allow each party their equal allotment of judges, except for one of our major parties doesn't have a ton of registered electors, so they may not be able to do that anyway. Another section of the bill requires two judges of different affiliations be present at the polling location at all times. It seems to be the case. There's no exclusion for nonpartisan elections, so it seems like there may need to be two judges of different affiliations, even though there's three political parties, and even during a nonpartisan election. The bill only allows for one watcher at a voter service and polling center, even though these centers are pretty large and pretty active. So we may promulgate a rule just saying one or more to allow more watchers there. And also with Election Day registration, it's a concern that watchers may be able to see confidential voter information during the registration process. So we're thinking about a rule similar to what we had with provisional ballots where, or even Uocopa ballots being duplicated, that watchers can watch that process a little bit removed. You know, they can't see the screen when somebody's being registered, and they can't listen to a voter give confidential information, but they can watch the process. So if there's no other questions on that section, I'll move on to the voting and counting process section. This is kind of a quirky one. For special district elections, the bill allows somebody to challenge an elector's eligibility based on that person being a civil union partner of a property owner in the special district, but that's not a, in Title 32, civil union partners of property owners are not eligible to vote right now. It's just spouse. So that challenge provision was thrown into Title 1, but no eligibility fixed in Title 32. One section of the bill that required judges to maintain poll books was repealed, but there's another section that still requires a judge to document the name and ballot number of every voter on the poll book. The bill requires an elector with a disability who votes in a voter service and polling place to sign an affirmation saying that they live in that subdivision and have not and will not cast a vote in the election. No other elector is required to sign that affidavit, so it seems a bit discriminatory. Not sure why it's in there or what the purpose of that is.
It's in current statute. Sorry, I'll save my comments.
One section of the bill requires the DEO to deliver ballot box keys to an election judge at the voter service and polling center, but another section requires the DEO to keep the ballot box keys until the ballots go to a counting place. So it's just another conflict there. Last one we have. The bill states that ballots that are received after 7 p.m. on election day must remain sealed and shall not be counted, but makes no exception for Uocalva voters who have until the 8th day after the election to return a ballot. So we would likely just promulgate a rule saying that, except for Uocalva voters, they should remain sealed and uncounted. So that's the list that I have. We're still going through, we're still finding things, so expect a pretty comprehensive rulemaking as we discover more things. And then I believe Hillary has a major, much more convoluted issue.
I do. I actually only have one issue that I'm going to talk about, but it's a little bit of an expansion on something Troy's already covered with respect to special districts. Under Title 32, all special districts are required to conduct their elections under Title 1, Articles 1 through 13 of Title 1. But when 1303 was passed, there was a new applicability clause added to Article 8 that says that it applies only to cities and special districts who choose to conduct their elections under Title 1. Unfortunately, Article 8 contains all of the absentee voting procedures that used to be for elections conducted by counties. So it contains a lot of provisions that special districts have never done, never have been required to do, and actually cannot do, like making the status of the ballot available to the voter, whether it's been received or not, through some electronic means, conducting signature verification, and those sorts of things. So there's a lot of procedures in there that special districts don't currently do, but it applies to special districts, not because they opt to follow Title I, but because they're statutorily mandated to. With all of the procedures required under Article 8 for special districts, it would essentially require them to coordinate. And as Troy has already mentioned, coordinating would be a significant challenge. They would be required to coordinate with every county in which the district lies, because language that was previously in law allowing the district to coordinate with the county where the most number of electors are has been repealed. So every county that is affected would be required to stand up a full countywide election to conduct it. And we're sort of hitting this issue now. We're working with special districts and cities to try to find a solution for next spring. But we're hitting this now because we've got a couple of special districts who are trying to conduct organizational elections this fall who've submitted mail ballot plans. And for each district, it's 10 or fewer electors for these districts. And so if these districts would be required to coordinate with the counties in which the district is situated, they would be required to pay potentially more to conduct the election than they may actually get out of holding the election to organize the district. And these are organizational elections, so the districts don't actually have any means yet to coordinate with these counties. So that's why we're trying to sort out this particular problem right now, is to give some guidance to these districts. If we look outside of Article 8 to Article 7.5, which is where these districts would have traditionally looked to conduct a mail ballot election, it appears that they could opt to do a mail ballot election under the applicability clause of Article 7.5, but there's no procedures. Troy mentioned that there is no formula for any election except the county conducted election. So there's no guidance for the special districts in terms of how many voter service and polling centers they would need to set up, number of drop-off locations, and arguably because in every mail ballot election a voter service and polling center is required, it would require all of the services required for voter service and polling centers under Article 5. So again, it would require procedures that the districts don't currently provide and have never been required to provide, like accessible voting equipment and election day registration. So we're a little unsure at this point what guidance to give to these districts, because if they coordinate, again, every single jurisdiction where the district sits, they're going to need to do an IGA to pay each of those counties and to pay them, again, to stand up a full countywide election, even if it's only in one county, a countywide election for 10 electors. So we could adopt some rules, but likely, as Troy mentioned, those rules would directly conflict with what the statute says, and we're not exactly sure how to go about giving these folks advice at this point for elections that might be conducted in August, September, or some other date in November. So that one just sort of spins itself in a circle. Article 8 applies, except if you don't apply it, but you apply Article 8. It's like a riddle. We're not sure what to do with it.
And some of the elections that are coming up are special district organizing elections, so these districts don't exist yet, so don't have the money to coordinate with the county clerk and recorder, and certainly don't have the money to put on an election themselves. So we're kind of stuck in a bind with that one. Don't know how to resolve it. Wish we had some recommendations on rules, but we don't at this time.
And we're probably going to be promulgating a temporary rule on that in the very near future. We have a couple mail ballot plans that are in right now that need to be approved within the next 10 days. So you'll probably see whatever our decision is regarding what to do with that in the next few days. We just need to internally talk about the legal issues that go along with that. But as Troy said, a couple of them are organizational elections, which have been ordered by the court already, so they can't move their dates. It's already in the in their service plan, which has been approved by the court. So we have an issue whether we just allow the special districts to violate the law, whether we try to pass a rule that's going to be in conflict with the law to try to give them some guidance. So we'll be doing something on that.
Cindy Acree, is there a possibility that we could, by rule, grandfather certain size districts under their old procedures just to give us some temporary fixes until we can make them take, you know, some discussion on amendments to this?
Well, that's kind of what a temporary rule does. It's just that, you know, we have rulemaking authority under, you know, to clarify things, but not to just pass rules in direct contradiction of the statute. So if the statute says one thing and we pass a rule saying something else, then it's quite probable that it won't make it through the rulemaking process, because we have to get sign off from the Attorney General's office. You know, from a timing perspective, they don't get reviewed by OLLS for, you know, a few months, and so they don't get overturned by the legislature or sunsetted until there would be a chance to do some fixes. But we still have issues of, one, passing something that we know is in contradiction to the statute, but two, you know, getting the Attorney General's sign off on it.
Is there any possibility that implementation of this law could be put on hold for that purpose?
No, it would have had to have been done by the legislature during the session, and none of the amendments we offered regarding special districts were accepted. So, and I mean, that's the other issue, is that we did attempt to do some clarification and some fixes to this. So at this point, we can only assume that the legislature chose to do it this way. You know, I mean, sometimes you can say something's an oversight, but when you have proposed something to do a fix and the legislature has said no, then you have to assume it's not a fix that they wanted.
Unless there's a legal remedy that would imply that there is some type of discrimination or inequity here that would require an injunction that would prevent it from taking.
Sure, but somebody has to, I mean, we've thought about that too, but you need a plaintiff. And so there's some legal standing issues with that, which is, you know, who's your plaintiff? And we don't have one right now. You'd be asking a special district that's not formed yet to put the legal fees to essentially sue the secretary's office. And so that's not a very viable remedy.
How many
either.
Special districts are currently impacted by this in this upcoming election?
Well, our hope is they're not going to be impacted in the May election and that the legislature will fix this. But between now and the effective date of any kind of fix, we have a number having anybody who tries to form a special district between now and then is going to run into this problem. Special districts which may be holding their elections not in May, special districts that are doing recalls, special districts that, you know, have other issues that just pop up throughout the year. Perhaps if they're doing a Tabor question, you know, I don't know.
No district elections between now and January that you're aware of.
Actually, there are some two special districts
that we know of that will be impacted.
And we know
there's immediately.
Yeah, we know there's more. We just haven't received their mail ballot plans yet.
There are any other questions, either for Hillary or Troy? Go ahead, Bob.
Since rulemaking is important to coming out with business processes and then software changes and. We have a lot of work to do. Do we have a time frame for resolving some of these issues that require new rulemaking?
Oh, they're both stepping away from that microphone.
Well, I mean, if we can't get this done, then we can't get ready for the elections, right? So it seems like it's step one in a fairly complex and time-consuming process. So I think we should be concerned about the schedule.
Well, and one of the issues that we've had, quite frankly, is we started down the route of fixing, you know, doing a fix here and there, and then it became clear that what we really needed to do was an entire recodification. And so that has become, not to say that we haven't been meeting our deadlines, but it has been a very arduous process. So I'll let them speak to the...
We've actually been conducting meetings since the bill passed in order to start tackling these issues that... I mean, from the issues that we've just discussed today, you can see that they're big issues that we can't sort of just snap our fingers and fix in a single meeting. So each issue has required several meetings to discuss. And we're in the process of drafting up the changes to the rules now. I think initially we had hoped to have an initial draft out for pre-rulemaking notice comment by the end of June. But as Suzanne mentioned, as we started going through this, we realized that a full recodification was necessary. So our current timeline is that we would issue temporary rules and a simultaneous notice of rulemaking no later than August 1st, because we know that the counties need to have rules in place that they can rely on for the November election. So that's really the drop dead that we're working against. And obviously, we'd like to get things out much, much sooner than that, but it's just a matter of actually having the meetings and talking through the issues and getting it done.
Well, let me make it clear that I'm not criticizing your pace of work. I mean, it looks like a tremendously complex, difficult job, so I'm just getting concerned. I think we all should be, that we have a schedule that's doable to, I mean, our job as a commission is to see if we can get there and to try to do everything we can to make sure that we do. So that's where I'm coming from, and I think we have to, you know, we ought to have a very clear idea of what our overall schedule is as we go forward.
Let me recognize that the deadlines in the bill were so aggressive, as of the effective date of the bill. So we already feel like we're trying to play catch up, and as I mentioned, we're still discovering things, and frankly, some of them, like the special district issue Hillary went through, we have yet to be able to come up with a fix for. So we're working on it. Like Hillary said, hopefully by August 1st we'll have those put together.
And I have one other question. I have a very special interest. I mean, there are only two legislators on this commission, and you know, we're likely to go back in session next year with, it sounds like we're going to go back in with some legislation. So as soon as those issues pop out that look like they need to result in legislation, I think I'd like to talk about them, wouldn't you, Senator? So keep us apprised of those things that don't fit in rulemaking that look like we will need to go forward with legislation in the next session.
We'd love to as well, and hopefully we can be part of the process next year.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. So now we have the review of the July 15th deadline report. I'm assuming Mr. Pepp is on the line.
Yes, Paul Kress here.
You're on.
And I again have the echo on this line, so I may be talking a little strange. Okay. And Madam Chair, may I proceed?
Please, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, basically our approach to this draft was to go through in detail the recording of last week's meeting. And based on the draft that we presented to you last week, do changes that were either grammatical in nature or we specifically address comments and things that y'all talked about in your last meeting. And then we received one set of comments from Commissioner Nunes, and we put those in on top of ours, giving precedent to her comments wherever we have. One issue that we learned about this morning, apparently Commissioner Long's comments did not get to us. We received them about 10:30 this morning. I went through them roughly, quickly, and I have to look to the commission as to what you want to do about incorporating those comments or not. So with that said, I guess I'll start through the document if that's your preference.
Great.
Okay, well, on page 2, the executive summary, we added the heading separating the needs between 213 and 214. On page 3, the top paragraph there, we basically added comments by Commissioner Nunes addressing the early vote use in previous elections and kind of coming down to a conclusion that steps should be taken to determine the extent of the risk and address it. And we have referenced a chart showing the numbers of early voting centers previously by counties and the number of ESPCs required, which I found this week I do not have. I requested Commissioner Hall to provide us a copy of that. But at this point, we have a placeholder there to incorporate that in the report.
I believe that was sent to you this morning from Amber. She's working with me on that.
Okay. Yes. Now, I couldn't tell in what Amber sent me, and I addressed a question back to her, where that shows, which column shows the early voting sites or vote centers that they used previously. It seemed to very carefully lay out the needs for the future.
We'll follow up. It's in there, so we'll follow up with you on that then, offline.
Yeah, and that's the place that, I say, the placeholder's in there for it. I don't think it changes the actual findings in the report. So, going on, page 4, there were no changes. Page 5, we added as the leading goal in the description of the systems, ensuring that every eligible voter has the opportunity to vote. At the bottom of page 6, we've, I think, come very close to the language that y'all wanted in last week's meeting as to the design of SCORE and the fact that it was not intended to process same-day registration and voting, although it can handle emergency registrations.
And Mr. Kraft, this is Elena. To go back just a little bit, I'm looking at the comments that Commissioner Long sent, and I think she made a note on the chart before that about clarifying Department of Corrections. I'm not entirely sure, looking at the black and white, where the comment was supposed to go, but that might be one thing as we go through we might want to just make the adjustment.
She did, and I think earlier in the document, corrections is shown as being synonymous with the Department of Corrections.
Okay, so that's one that's already been addressed.
I think. I don't know. We will need to double-check that. I mean, basically, I remember at an earlier point later in the document, I came across the use of corrections and vital records and questioned my partners on whether we had defined that term, and I was shown somewhere that we did, so I think that's defined. But I'll double check that. Okay. At the bottom of that page, once again, we go into the as designed piece. And then on page 7, continuing that paragraph, at the bottom of the paragraph, we have Mr. Nunes' description of, you know, how the voter's application was processed and eligibility determined. And then there's, you know, the issue of the corrections and vital record data only occurring on a monthly basis. The next paragraph discusses the support for early voting and vote centers. Designed in an area where voter rolls generally close to a new registration 29 days before.
I'm sorry, Mr. Kraft. I need you to back up just a sec. My notes show differently from what you just said, in that it was explicitly going to be reflected that SCORE is capable of handling same-day registration.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand.
Sorry, I'll try that again. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
This is Jesse Danielson. I just wanted to note that my notes from the last meeting said that, yes, you would change that the system already handles emergency or same-day registrations, but you were also going to explicitly add that SCORE is capable of handling same-day registration.
I think we have that, don't we?
Yeah. No, it
at
says
the bottom of page 6.
And if you're satisfied with that. Well, if no one else has a problem with that, then that's okay.
Okay, it's okay. Okay, so I guess second paragraph, page 7, we've got the discussion of the system support for early voting and vote centers. And let's see. Once again, we've got Colorado law did provide for emergency registration, with emergency registration of voter in specified circumstances could register to vote a regular ballot. That also addresses that. Page 8, first full paragraph. Basically, we've brought in the testimony that you received at your last meeting regarding the enhancement for ballot on demand being for the Runbeck system. Okay, so proceeding on. Page 8, the second paragraph underneath the 213, we've added that during your July 1st meeting, you received a progress report on the business practices subcommittee, and that you're planning to receive and discuss a draft of their business process today. And you spoke of posting the draft for comment and finalizing the draft by July 15th. I don't remember that y'all voted on that or did anything other than discuss it happening. The next paragraph, there's a need for promulgating rule changes, and we changed that paragraph consistent with last week's vote. And basically, I left the close of that paragraph. The division's task includes identifying the items that can be clarified through rulemaking period.
We have a question. We have a question, Mr. Kraft. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes.
Bob Rankin. I wonder that after listening to the report today on the rules, maybe rulemaking is not the second need but the first need. Doesn't the rulemaking need to precede the finalization of business processes?
I We felt when we did the original draft it was a chicken and egg question. I think, you know, the business process should feed into the draft rules. But the draft rules obviously are going to ultimately affect the business process. I will basically, you know, bow to the commission's decision on that.
Maybe we should discuss. I'm still going back to my schedule question about how the rules and the business process interact, and, you know, which is the chicken and which is the egg. So.
I don't know, Representative. Yeah, the point we were trying to make in this is that both of those are critically important and urgent.
Does anyone else have any other comments or concerns? Elena?
I mean, my sense, I was on the call last week about the business model, and my sense is that a lot of it is distinct, so I think we could order it either way, but there is plenty that's separate, so I think it's fine either way.
Okay. Leave it the way it is.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Kraft.
Okay, then on page 9, the last paragraph. And let's see. Okay. I've lost my train of thought for a moment, if you'll pardon. Yes, this is where we tried to distinguish between current processes that may require modification and new processes. And that was basically Commissioner Nunes' changes, which look good to us. The bottom of page 10, the last paragraph. This is basically addressing the issue of planning, developing procedures, and monitoring the VSPCs to ensure that you, I guess, at this point, maximize the compliance with the ADA. In listening to the discussion last week, it sounded like there was, you know, there were some areas where there was not compliance, and that's an ongoing project to improve compliance. Once again, these are Commissioner Nunes' suggested changes. Let's see, page 11, third paragraph. We came back to the issue of the felon and vital record. And Commissioner Nunes' changes are first at the bottom. We put in CDOS's interpretation of the Act and discussions with vital records and corrections. And at the July 1st meeting, the Commission discussed inviting representatives of vital records and corrections to appear before the Commission and discuss possibility. Okay, and then the last paragraph. Basically, all the functions performed through the VSPCs are currently conducted through SCORE with the early voting registration modules. The secure web applications need to be used to create a more streamlined and integrated process for users. And on page 12, at the bottom, it needs to modify SCORE. We put in the new functions which were used. We put in a reference to the business practices subgroup evaluating the records of correspondence as part of the business process. And then had the modification to existing functions and struck three, which I think are already being done and won't substantially change. And then the bottom of 13, we had the placeholder for the charter counties comparing early voting sites to VSPC requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody have any questions for Mr. Kraft or any changes that might be necessary for his edits? Elena?
Thanks. So, I don't know. I think Commissioner Long is on the phone and she can chime in. As I was comparing her comments to the draft, it seemed like the big gap were the comments she made on page 7 about the analysis, what was technical versus a new need, and then about load and connectivity. I think most of the others were more or less addressed through the different edits that were made. Does that seem right, Fran?
That is correct. On the requirement need, when I was going through the spreadsheet, I was noticing that a lot was already addressed. I would like to see a number here that shows what we need to, as he did with the 10, he referenced 10 that rely on the need for the business process.
Okay, I'm having quite a deal of difficulty hearing because of the echo. As I understand it, Commissioner Long, you want us to quantify the requirements that have already been met and those that haven't?
That is correct.
Okay.
I believe the other area, I'm looking for it just a moment. Go ahead and I'll find it.
Does anyone else have anything else while we're looking for, while Fran's looking for that?
I have a general request.
Sure. Go ahead, Jesse.
So since given the strange timeline of the holiday and then receiving this morning and the other documents that we received this morning, it seems to me with Commissioner and County Clerk Long's comments not being really fully integrated or Mr. Kraft not really having time to process them into it, it might be worth an extra day to review what he's written, how he's written it, and then if we have anything else to say, give that back. And I don't mean an extensive amount of time, but to read through his edits, you know, more in depth, have a little more time to respond to them and make sure that our understanding of what was discussed last week is actually incorporated there. And then that would also give County Clerk Long's, you know, her comments time to get in there, and maybe other commissioners who had other thoughts that they saw needed added. And really just one day, I think, would be enough. That would be my request.
Does anyone have a issue with that? For me personally, I think that's helpful to me.
The process question I have, yeah, is then how do we
bring that all back together?
How do we bring that back together in time for next week's meeting? And what might the timeline or process look like for that? I agree, one day to get our comments by end of day tomorrow seems reasonable, but then after that,
right, how do we... Richard.
Madam Chairwoman. This is Richard Westfall. I guess the only question I have about that is that this meeting was designed to be, and I understand what you're saying about the holidays, but to the extent to which we had comments or questions that we would collectively sort of chew through, if you will, this was the chew through meeting. And if subsequent recommendations get made that we may have to discuss, then I guess we're just going to have to, it'll be a drafting on the fly session next Monday.
I have in my notes that we were actually going to receive another draft either Wednesday or Friday, and we never received that draft, and so this seems to be that draft, because I was prepared and had set aside time waiting for that next version, which is this version, and so I'm not sure how we work that in. So based on
we reviewed that closely on the tape. And y'all initially discussed getting a draft on Wednesday. We offered to provide you whatever we had drafted at that point. and the resolution of that issue was just to stick to the plan and provide you with a draft today.
Like, for example, the only comments that I saw were substantive as of yesterday were Elena's comments. And so basically what I did was I sat down with my notes yesterday afternoon, and I looked at my notes and compared that to Elena's draft, because she had actually taken the time to essentially, I thought, try to summarize what we did. Like, for example, acknowledge that the one issue we did take a vote on with respect to deleting that one sentence on the conflicts, we did that, and Elena's draft did that. So I did that, you know, anticipating that that would be where we are today. But anyway, if there's a desire to want to go ahead and do some additional exchange, I'm just saying we may end up with some substantive issues next Monday, and we'll deal with them. So.
And I guess it would be my preference to know them before we get to next Monday, whatever the process is, if we can.
I'm concerned about the timeline. I think we've already got a lot of challenges with the discrepancies between interpretation of the statute and rulemaking ability in some of those. So in the spirit of moving forward, maybe we just resolve that there could be an addendum if we have some points that we feel like need to be made after this report is finalized and we have the final copy at the next meeting. Go ahead and finalize it.
Anybody else have any further comments? Elena.
Well, I guess one question is, what is the plan for next Monday? Is that the day that we are going to deliver the report to the committees, or is that the day we're going to take the vote and finalize it? Do we have time if we were to do additional editing? Could we still have a final report next Monday? And what do we see ourselves doing next week? Because if all it is taking a vote and then sending it across the street, maybe we could do that in one day. If we're going to brief state affairs on the 15th, it seems like we would need to have a final version, whether we have additional calls this week or something. We would have to do it pretty quickly.
Go ahead, Bob.
What's the process for delivery? Is state affairs actually going to meet and we brief them, or do we deliver by email, or what do we expect to actually happen?
I'm not sure, but I don't imagine that state affairs is meeting at all during the off session. So, right. And I don't know if Suzanne, if anytime we've encountered something like that, which you might be able to, any precedent that had been set. What it might be is that we would have time on Monday, because the timeline doesn't seem to feel as tight as it might look like on in writing. So.
The bill just says it has to be presented to state affairs by the 15th, so I think presented can mean
in
email or
right.
Whatever form.
An email at 11:59 at night, the PDF, I think, would be compliant.
Compliant with presenting to the court.
So with that in mind, that we might have time on Monday, would a... somewhat of the recommendation that Cindy gave us is that we might be able to come back with any substantive as well as any technical things and put that on the agenda as a item next Monday.
And Jeff, I know we're always, we have our weekly meetings, but since we're so tight on this timeline, as Representative Acree brought up, and there's nothing preventing us from, well, you tell me if there's anything preventing us from calling a special conference call or something that's open to the public Thursday. Since we have to meet this deadline, and we may want to add changes to the report that apparently is in some, obviously we need to present formally to the State Affairs Committee. If you don't think we can get there on Monday, and some of us would like a chance to review it so that we feel confident in its content, are we in any way prevented from doing a special quick check-in just on the content of the revisions that we've suggested?
There's nothing that prevents us. We just need 24 hours notice to post it and put out an agenda.
And if you're satisfied with the content and don't have anything to add, you could still call in and make sure that nothing's gone off course. But, if you're concerned about the timeline, that's one thing I would say, because I would rather get on the phone for a half an hour or meet here for a half an hour than hold up the system by pushing it down the, you know, the road another week? Or not having the chance to change the content at all?
Really important. So does anyone have any objections to Jesse's recommendation that we might have a call-in check-in time on Thursday?
Now, we have an issue. Freeman Craft McGregor has a conference call with another client scheduled from 10 to noon on Thursday.
10 to what? I'm sorry, Mr. Craft.
Or, excuse me, 10 to noon Eastern time. So that would be 8 to 10 your time.
Would it be a possibility that we could work around that then? I mean, if we did a 2:30 or 3 o'clock time. Are you amenable to, if we worked around that 12 to 2 your time schedule, to still put in a half an hour call?
12 to 2 is going to put you right after their meeting. How about 1 to 3 my time?
Okay. So,
so
that works.
11 to 1 mountain time.
Right. So we could do a 1 to 1:30, or we could block out 1 to 2 on a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Time for a check-in?
1 to 2 Eastern, 11 to noon Mountain.
11 o'clock, okay.
I'll have to check on conference room availability on that.
Okay.
But I can follow up if we want to either take a break sometime today or follow up by close of business today with specific scheduling, keeping in mind Mr. Kraft's schedule.
Okay, great. Bob?
Do we intend that to be our final discussion of the report? I mean, I have schedule conflicts all the time that week, so, you know, I sort of plan Monday afternoons. But are we going to come back next Monday and finally approve the report if we discuss the comments on Wednesday?
It's on Thursday, but I think that would be...
Have another shot at it next Monday.
That's my that's the way I'm interpreting it. Anybody else?
Well, I think anything we present Monday, you're going to be hard-pressed to get changed in final form and over the legislature. So we really need on Thursday to basically have a near-final draft before y'all.
I mean, Thursday's just a... I don't know if I'm going to call in or not. I'm leaving town on Wednesday for a family vacation, and they're all about ready to leave me already, so I don't know that I'm calling in the first day of my vacation. But, I mean, if it was a time later in the afternoon, I don't know what other people's schedules are. I know I'm not going to be able to call in the morning.
We're talking Wednesday now again?
Thursday. I'll be on a plane Wednesday.
I'm in court all day.
Yeah.
So we're talking Thursday. And I guess the time is still a little bit open. Bob, is there some time, if you wanted to get on the call, that is a better time based on Mr. Kraft's other client?
I mean, I'll try. I have an uncertain set of commitments on Thursday at the moment, so that's my problem. And I hate to think we may have substantial changes. I don't know how people are feeling about the... Are we just fine-tuning, or is somebody looking at substantial problems with the content?
Well, I think at least for... Well, I can speak for myself in that I didn't have that chance to review it, go back and forth. Especially it was a little challenging for me, as you probably noted, to be on the phone when I was looking back and forth and all of that. And so I just want to go back and look and compare... I feel like I need to be a little bit more thorough. So I'm not anticipating necessarily, but I do feel that in order to do my due diligence, I need to go back and do that. So that's what I'm planning on.
What is
this is Fran. I feel the same way. The comments that I have made are not substantive, and Commissioner Nunes did address a lot of them.
Cindy Acree, what's the process for resolving differences of opinion in terms of what we amend the report to read, how we amend the report to read if we don't have everyone on the conference call?
So, Mr. Kraft, would you be able to, let's say everybody wasn't on the call, and there was two different versions. You could have the two different versions ready to go. We could take that vote on Monday, which would give you that time that's on Thursday that you would have needed, would not have been acceptable if we would have just had the discussion on Monday. Does that work for you?
I'm a little confused. So basically, from the conversation I understood earlier, y'all are going to provide additional changes by the close of business tomorrow. And then we were expecting we would have those to y'all in time for you to consider at the conference call on Thursday.
Right. What I guess would be is that we would be on Thursday, if not everybody, and it doesn't sound like everyone may not be able to be on the call if there was some disagreement on that, that we would still give you enough time if we did some, if we made the actual vote, if we weren't able to do it by consensus on Monday. Does that give you enough time?
As long as we are, or the commission is deciding between two clear alternatives and a string of text, we can put that in by Monday.
Okay. Bob?
I don't, from your conversations, I just don't see where there are any clear disagreements thus far.
I would agree. Bob, you have a comment?
I think that's true. I don't think we have any clear disagreements. If everybody commits to get their changes in tomorrow, I think we're fine, you know, because we get to look at them, and even if we're not able to be in the meeting on Thursday, we know whether there are any big issues or not. That's what concerns me, and I think that would work just fine.
Great. All righty. Does that sound good to everyone?
And,
great.
And I do have medical appointments all day Wednesday, so my time on this is going to be limited to a couple of hours Thursday morning. So if we wind up getting major rewrites that can't be just posted or pasted back in, then we've got a problem.
I don't think anyone here is anticipating a major rewrite. So,
okay.
Elena.
Well, if we could just make sure that we reply all so that we can look at them, we can also start reviewing comments if there are substantive rewrites before waiting for a new draft on Thursday. So that would be helpful, at least for me.
Yeah, could y'all all copy each other on your comments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those just need to be, I mean, that's technically a continued meeting. So if that's what we're going to do, we need to post that, and then we need to put the comments on as we get them for the public. So just as long as everybody understands that if we're going to comment that way, we need to be compliant with the open meetings law.
What time is it?
I don't.
When are comments due?
Is there a? Do we have a set time on Tuesday when we want to make that all comments are due? Is that necessary? Is that helpful to you, Mr. Kraft?
Earlier in the day would be better. I said the close of business a while ago, so 5 p.m. Mountain Time or earlier if y'all are so mine.
We might need to do some compromising on that here. So I'm wondering if a 2 or 3 time our time works for you. That isn't
two or three.
In the afternoon. I mean, that isn't in the morning. For sure.
Yeah, trying to be nice.
2 or 3 your time would be very nice.
Okay.
How about 3?
Okay, we're going to take total advantage of the situation. We're going to go for 3.
Should we call you at 3 a.m. with questions?
So what we would do is just reply all by 3 o'clock our time for any changes, and then you would have that. Then we would meet at or have a potential for a call on Thursday after people have had a chance to review any changes, and I'm not sure we set a time for that. For Thursday's call.
So, I'm just going to inform that we have conference room availability on Thursday downstairs in the Blue Spruce at 11 a.m. We can schedule an hour. Is that correct, Trevor? Yeah, so from 11 to noon, we can set up a conference call downstairs. Should eliminate the echo on the line, too, as an added bonus.
That's an added bonus. Okay, so 11 o'clock on Thursday, those who want to call in, and it would be the same number, Steve, that we've been utilizing to call in. And we could discuss any changes that have been made that we've all previously seen through an email chain. And then
okay,
so we'll post
on
that.
On Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern.
Right. 1 o'clock Eastern.
Okay.
Jesse.
Quick question. So we can actually meet in person down there?
Yeah, you can attend in person if you want to or by conference call.
And then members of the public can attend?
Yes, it'll be an open meeting. We'll post that by close of business today and then get the comments online when they come in tomorrow.
Thank you.
Great. So is there anything else on that? Okay.
Okay. Well, we will await your changes tomorrow.
All righty. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, Al, you're up next on our UBS briefing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Al Davidson, UVS project lead. Actually, the first item that we have to discuss with you is not a UVS item at all. You had asked for us to draft some language to put into the request for quotes for your next report. And I believe that Steve has provided you with the document, a draft request for quotes for the statutorily required needs assessment. And what I did on this was basically take the boilerplate from your first one that you did. Do they all have that, Steve?
They should.
Okay. Take the boilerplate from what you had on your first one, and I didn't touch that. I worked with the content. So in the first paragraph, I replaced the language that was there with a specific section relating to the second report, so that's all just directly out of the statute. And then down under documented quote requirements, beginning with 1A, we replaced all the language that was there and included the language for the second report. And the way it reads is, because you probably haven't had much time to go over it, that the needs assessment must describe, item A, the current state of technology relating to, number one, voting systems. This must include an analysis of voting systems currently used in Colorado and voting systems that may be available that would allow counties to conduct elections in accordance with the provisions of House Bill 1303. Item number two, current state of technology relating to certification of voting systems. This must include an analysis of voting systems currently certified for use in Colorado. I made a change here. And the process and timeline for certifying voting systems that are not currently certified by Colorado, the Elections Assistance Commission, or any other state. Then item three, the current state of technology relating to replacement of voting systems. This must include an analysis of counties' needs for replacing voting systems, the type of systems necessary under the new election model, as well as timing issues based on the election's calendar. The analysis should also consider the Department of State's initiative to develop uniformity in voting systems throughout the state. That's Section A. And Section B, then, is the analysis of the election-related technology cost and funding sources required by the bill, and this must include an estimate of cost of equipment needed to conduct elections as described in House Bill 1303, and an analysis of funding sources that may be available or may potentially be made available for the purchase of new voting systems. As you go out for your request for your report, it seemed to me in reading the bill over a number of times and listening to your discussion, those are the elements that need to be in that next report. Now, a couple of items that I didn't have information about. In your first one, you had a not-to-exceed cost, and I don't know what that was. I think it was $24,000 in your first study. I don't know what your budget is or what number you want to put in there, so that's a to-be-determined item. And then the other to-be-determined item is over on the on the date at the very end, the how to respond. And your original, for the original report, it was a certain date, and obviously that date's not going to work for this, and I don't know what date you want to have that report done. So those are two items that you need to fill in, and we have to answer any questions on anything else that's in here.
Richard.
Thanks very much for doing this, going above and beyond the call of duty here. With respect to the first items, voting systems and certification of voting systems, how much with your uniform voting system project that you're doing right now, would you have some data that would readily go into answering those first two questions, or first two points?
Cal.
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner, the report I provided you at your last meeting listed all the systems that are currently certified. It also listed all those that are currently certified by the EAC that are not certified here. The question here is there are systems out there that are being developed that have not been through the certification process. And Colorado law allows either us to certify, or they can be certified by another state, and we can evaluate and determine whether or not we want to accept the certification by another state. It's highly likely that we could get, well, it's certain we'll get proposals, and it's I don't know what the likelihood is that we will choose a system that is currently not certified. But I think in your report, I think the bill requires that that your vendor analyze that situation and point out to you what the issues are there. That's why I wrote it the way I did.
Richard.
Madam Chairwoman, so what that would entail, Al, is not just what you've collected so far and what you provided to us, kind of a snapshot of what we have currently in Colorado, but what is currently available to Colorado. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying the assessment should also take that into consideration as well, which would be above and beyond what you've already done to this point.
Commissioner, I think that for your own needs, that's what you should ask for. Now, everything that's available out there may not be known at this point. How much information your vendor in writing this report will be able to gather on that, I'm not sure. But at least I think the issue should be broached.
Thanks, Hal. Any other? Go ahead, Bob.
Just to review, I know there have been several committees working on the U.S. issues, and it would be my hope that this incorporates all of that input. So just to review,
Madam Chair, Commissioner, yes, there is. There's the advisory committee, and that's the information I provided you at your last meeting is information that was developed for that committee. There is the public participation panel, whose job is to collect public opinion and public comments about this whole process. And to this point, they don't. They haven't really delved into anything substantive that I think relates to the certification issue here. I mean, obviously, it is an issue about systems that are certified or systems that may be certifiable, particularly for certain members of that panel. So I think that's an issue that's going to be part of their conversation, but I don't know that we have anything substantive to talk to you about putting into this report yet. I would encourage your vendor to maybe talk to some of the folks on that public participation panel as they prepare your report. These are your instructions to the vendor. You can put in there anything you want. Yes, sir. And one thing that may be of some assistance on that, this was another thing I was going to report on as a result of working with the public participation panel, and they are holding hearings around the state to accept public comment. We posted as of this morning all the system requirements that we have developed for the RFP for our uniform voting system on our website and put out information to all kinds of groups, and you're one of the ones that's scheduled to get an email with that information as well. And we're allowing them to comment and get their comments back to us. We post it on our website. They can download it and provide their comments and then send those back to us for our evaluation. Because of the time frame, we are we need to have those comments back in by next Sunday night. So those comments might be instructive for you as well, and we can probably have a summary for you on those maybe by your Monday meeting. It sounds like your Monday meeting might be full already with the current report.
Cindy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, after our conversation about the rules and the various issues that we brought up, do you see any of those issues that would severely impact the direction of this needs assessment or some of the components we put in this needs assessment for their technical capability, whether or not they're resolved prior to that assessment?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, the only exposure I've had to those rules was the discussion you had today, so I really am not prepared to say that. It's something I have to take under some advisement.
Because I think it's important that we get your feedback on which one of those issues, you know, it's kind of putting the cart before the horse or the horse before the cart. But we've got to be able to determine what's going to impact the functionality of the system. Analyze this needs assessment.
Hillary might be a better person to answer that, but I think one of the problems with that is that this is going to be a long-term purchase for the counties, a long-term solution, and even with rules, we don't know what could potentially happen in the legislation next year, for instance, if we truly have to have special districts, able to provide centers and a full-blown election. That's a different analysis mm-hmm. than the counties doing it. So without an answer to that question, even if we propose a rule, that's not a final answer to that question. So what we're really going to be able to, or what we're going to have to do is do an analysis according to what I guess the counties think they need, because I don't think the special districts, I think that's too up in the air for them to be able to answer that question. They don't even have the expertise on staff to know the answer to the question.
And that was one of several issues I thought that would impact the technical aspects of modifications either we make to a system or what we look at in a new system to purchase. So absent resolving the issues, however we resolve it through statute or rulemaking, do any of those issues impact to any large degree the type of system that we purchase or modify up front, or does that limit us to a system that can be customized as we go along? I'm just want to be sure we don't rush through this and inadvertently end up with something like CBMS.
I don't think we have any choice but to rush through this. So, I don't know how to answer that question because the timelines are set by statute and the implementation is set by statute. So, you know, we don't have a lot of choice but to go with what we have in front of us. And, you know, while I agree maybe we shouldn't rush through, I don't know that that's our option.
So is there any way we can mitigate spending money we don't have to spend or spending money irresponsibly? I'm really concerned about this process.
No, UVS is not set by statute. UVS is advisory. The only thing set by statute is just this report. Right. But whether counties have to buy new equipment, that has to do with when their certifications expire. And I think the issue that you have is that some counties, you know, want to buy equipment that's going to be part of the uniform future. And so if they have to buy equipment for this next election, they don't want to go out and purchase something that then is not going to be uniform with what everyone else is using. Now, you know, from a practical standpoint, we're not going to mandate that people go out and buy new equipment if they have equipment that is certified.
Which raises a question for me. I mean, maybe a needs assessment. Could a part of a needs assessment be the right schedule? You know, just tend to look at reasonable schedules for implementing the system. I mean, we're on a fast timeline of this. Maybe too fast.
Hillary, did you have a...
Yeah, I would add on to that, and that would be, these were parallel tracks. The USV was going on while this bill was being created, and I would hope that would be some of the information we would get. How are these going to fit together? What are our long-term needs going to be, and has that been looked at as part of the system? And you know, is USV the answer, or are there other options? I mean, that would be my hope with where we're at.
This might be a chance to interest.
Mm-hmm. How do we weave all of those moving parts together? That's my, what I would love to see come out of this assessment, and I believe that was some of the original intent of that assessment was that. So.
Let's be sure we include.
Well, and I think that's included in the analysis, considering the DOS initiative to develop uniformity in the voting system. So I think that the report would, I mean, we could beef that language up or talk to whoever we select about that prior to setting them out. But,
I agree. Okay. Anything else for Al?
Madam Chair, the only other thing... related to UBS is this commission had indicated an interest in piggybacking on the questionnaire that's going out to the surveys, out to the counties. The survey is going out. Both the advisory committee, I think you saw it's six questions before, and you made a comment that that some of the information they were asking for was not necessary as far as what was past practice. And in the draft that the advisory committee is working with now, they've taken those out, and in what you just handed out, you see a kind of a reformation of those six questions and an expansion on item number six. Estimate of quantities of what equipment you'll need to conduct the 2014 election if you were replacing your equipment. And then we list all the different kinds of equipment there. The public participation panel considered a number of questions that were submitted by members and determined that they would, on the survey, include a single question, which is a ranking of values, essentially principles relating to an election, and so that question is on there. At this point, we don't have any specific questions from you. We are looking at distributing the survey on the 12th. That's the date specified by the date specified by the chair of the advisory committee, and so. I don't know whether you have questions that you want to propose now or that you want to consider later. We can always do another survey. The goal was to try to get as much in this survey as we can without overburdening them because we want a rapid response on it. So I wanted to bring that issue before you so you could kind of give me some guidance on how you want to proceed on this.
Yeah. Does anyone, as you're looking it over, do you want to just have a couple of minutes just to look it over? Or?
It'd be great.
Okay, yeah, we'll just take a couple minutes just to review it.
Does anybody have any feedback for Al? Oh, Richard.
Madam Chair, it looks like a lot of good stuff is going to come out of the survey, but what's maybe a little short on is the first item that's required for our September 2nd report, which is an analysis of including the current building systems. And maybe just a little bit more survey, if you will, or questioning or inquiry into current voting systems could provide a lot of detail to be very useful for our report. But it looks like what you're getting at here, what EBS is getting at, is definitely leading to some of the other, you know, the future needs and the delta, if you will. But maybe a little bit more inquiry could be done in existing voting systems.
Hillary. I know we've discussed this at previous meetings along those lines. I would like to recommend that we have lots of data on what the current systems are, how much, how many pieces, what types, the use. What are there specific questions about that would need more information? Again, we talked about that information has already been compiled to some degree. Are there any additional questions based on what was presented to us previously that you would ask on that lines? Otherwise, I feel like it's redundant information gathering from the counties, and especially for some of our smaller and medium counties. It does take quite a bit of time to gather the information for the surveys.
Thank you. Richard, and then we'll go to Elena.
Madam Chair, by Hillary, I'm speaking at a very 40,000-foot level from not knowing the data at all. So
okay.
If you're saying the existing data is already there and that the kind of inquiry I'm reacting to words on the page and
okay.
The statute and our tasks that we're going to have for September 2nd. And if you're saying that we already have that data and that would be redundant then to put that in this particular survey, then that's great, as long as we have that data.
Question. And then
I think I had the same reading as Richard, and I think it's because the underlined sentence said if you had to replace your equipment, what would you need? But then under number 6, it seems to be asking what do you already have and what do you need to supplement? And I think that might be getting to Richard's point. Is there new equipment required that's not that counties don't have that they would need to get that wouldn't be a full-scale overhaul? Because this seems to imply if you were going to replace everything, and I think it's more like, is there an intermediate step, which is not just using existing equipment, are there additional pieces, and maybe that could be asked in a clearer way.
Bob.
And I'm seeing this for the first time, so I sort of have the same reaction, yet I'm sympathetic to the fact that a lot of the data already exists. I wonder it might be appropriate, and I don't want to drag this out forever, but, you know, in the context of us looking and having input due, could we have a data to also look at these questions, pose additional questions, and then, you know, Al could come back and say, we already have that. I mean, I don't want to force the questions, but I'd sure like to propose them, you know, just for my own edification. And if you come back and say, we don't need to ask that, we already know it, that's fine with me, but I haven't really had a chance to think through, you know, technically what I think I'd like to know.
Hillary.
Yeah. Well, and one piece I would suggest we look at is the equipment that I think it was just last meeting, they've all blurred together, that was provided by Al and his team on what information has already been gathered. We were given that in our packet. That's a pretty substantial chunk, and if there's something missing from that chunk, official word, that would be great to know, too. I'd be curious what that is.
Cindy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, based on the information you've already gathered, can you determine which counties have equipment that can be modified or updated or used without going back and asking the counties?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, that's way beyond the scope of what I've been involved in. We have collected information. We have information collected two ways. One, what equipment do you have? And that's retained by our voting systems program. They maintain an inventory of that. The question that the advisory committee tried to get to was what equipment do you use? Because there is equipment that counties have that they don't use necessarily with the evolution of elections. So we do have both of those both of those items, what the counties say that they use and what they actually have on hand. So I'm not sure how much further I can go with that.
Cindy.
It sounds like to me what we're really doing is an inventory of what we have and what we need, but absent finishing the needs assessment and the final report on the technological modifications that we're going to make, I don't know how we're going to know in advance what the counties are capable of doing with the equipment they have anyway.
Any other questions or feedback for Al?
But there is another line of questions. It's not just inventory, but what did they use and how did they use it? I mean, you know, if you could know everything, you'd like to know that. You'd like to know what was useful in the last cycle and what we need going forward. I know that's getting a little beyond what we might want to be able to tackle here, but I think that's coming out. I hear people asking that question.
Is there anything else? Okay. Do you feel like you have what you need from us, Al, on this then?
I think so. Thank you.
Help.
Could you tell us what that was?
May we submit?
I'm sure we landed anywhere, but that might just be me.
Well, do we have the opportunity to submit additional proposed questions and let them either be used or rejected?
Made a draft. I think the deadline is going out on Friday, so we have to do it over email if we got them to you
tonight.
Would that be soon enough, Wednesday even?
I'm sorry.
So Bob was asking if we had some other questions that we wanted to add to that. We know that you had the deadline that this is going out by Friday the 12th. If we submitted something in email form to you, is a question that is being proposed that could be?
That'd be fine. The advisory committee meets on the 11th.
Okay.
And we'll
so
be considering the final
Thursday.
Form
so
of this
Thursday summer. Morning at the latest, I guess, like.
Yeah, they meet at noon.
Okay, so by 8 o'clock or so.
That's an option for some people.
I guess if we do by email, I would want us to respond as a commission to say, yes, let's put that in, or
that's true.
What's the part, again, or what's missing.
Right. So then that we would have our own review of them before we would submit them as a commissioner's question or two that is being added.
Can't you just do it at your Thursday call? Or?
I'm sorry?
Don't you have your Thursday call anyway? Can't you just do it there?
It's a little tight. I think our call's at 11. They meet at 12, although we could. Or could we just do it over email if we reply all and if everyone gets their draft questions in by close of business tomorrow, we could just use Wednesday to debate if there's additional things to add or whatever?
Work.
That sounds reasonable. Okay.
Madam Chair, the other issue that I didn't hear an answer to, and maybe you're not prepared to do it now, is on the information about your assessment. What date you require the report to be done?
On the document quote, when do you want it back? Dates do you want to put in there?
So the requirement is September 2nd to have it to the legislature.
Right, we can fill that in, but what date does the commission want?
Yeah.
To get the quote back.
Oh, the quote back. Sorry.
We need to post it. I'm assuming you want to post it right away.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if we could do that right away. And then we're saying,
are we satisfied enough if we beef up the issue about the UBS timeline and, I don't remember, was there something else? That might have been it. In the draft form that it is the commission fine with the document quote? Okay.
People feel confident with that? Looks like people are shaking their heads.
So then what, we'll post it tomorrow? Is that all right? And then how long do you want to have it out?
One of those could be the sooner the better. We get it back. I think the sooner the better, just
although the meeting on the 15th is already looking pretty right. Cool. We think that would be the full 4-hour meeting. Do we think we'd get responses if we requested by Friday, since there's no holidays? And I guess we could see where we're at with that. And
we don't know. Last time we got 2.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would help if it was a longer response time or not. I have no idea.
So that would be the 22nd then. The meeting would be the 22nd that we would need to approve it in order to give them any time to... It's still a pretty aggressive timeline, but it seems like that's the choice.
Right, I don't think that seems like what we need to do.
I mean, it seems like it'd be worth giving them at least a week to see if we get a larger pool with a little bit of time. And then we could do it on the 22nd.
Okay.
So if we get them back by Tuesday or Wednesday of the following week, and then that would give us time to review them before the meeting as well.
Right.
Okay. Great. Is that all right? Get them back next Wednesday. Send them out. Post them. And then we'll discuss them that next Monday, the 22nd.
The other outstanding item is the quote, must not exceed, I'm assuming you want.
Yeah, it's the same
writing?
Amount.
The same amount? Yeah. That keeps it in the document quote range.
Right. All right. Thank you, Al. Appreciate all the time you spent on this.
Yes, absolutely.
So our next is a briefing on the business practices group, and that's Hillary. And then, Amber, are you going to join us at the table?
Walk us through for the podium.
We want to let you sit down.
I know. There's no mic. Sorry.
Time has come past.
So the group met on Wednesday afternoon, and Mr. Kraft, we can sympathize with you with the echo. We had a little bit of an echo on the meeting, so we have two processes. One, the first document that we'll review with you all today is from the voter perspective of what happens to different scenarios based on what the voter needs. And then at next week's, we'll give you the next layer down, which is the county end of the process. And then that will show you this shows where we interact with SCORE, but that might give you one additional layer of detail. They're working on finalizing that version, and we will, the goal is to get that out to you probably by Wednesday or Thursday this week to give you a little time to review it and have your questions. Right now, we have the business practice group members will be here on the 15th. We might, as part of this meeting, want to look at that agenda and see if that still makes sense based on everything we have to get in. Some people will be traveling, so I just want to make sure that we have enough time for them as well. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and let Amber walk us through what this is showing us and answer the questions that you may have.
Thank you. Welcome, Amber.
Is that on? Good afternoon. My name is Amber McReynolds. I'm the Director of Elections in Denver and also a member of the Business Practices Group, formerly SCORE Advisory Board. So we met last Wednesday to sort of talk about the business process and sort of come up with a consistent process that will hopefully be utilized statewide. So I think everyone agrees this is a good opportunity to review this and solidify the processes that counties will be following and hopefully obtain some consistency that hasn't been there previously. So a couple different things that we've done. The process that you have in front of you today is what we call a swim lane process in terms of sort of business process workflows. It's a swim lane, and on the far left side of the page, you'll see sort of the different scenarios that a voter may be coming to each of the service centers and why they may be coming to visit those service centers. And then each of the sort of flows are based on the reason that they may be there and then what their experience will look like as they go through. The top one is a registered voter with a completed mail ballot. So they would come to the service center to simply deposit their ballot in one of the various ways that are outlined in 1303. They may go inside the service center and obviously put it in a box inside. Counties may have a drive-up, drop-off at the site, or they may also deposit it in a 24-hour box that may be located outside the service center or in another location. The next one down a registered voter with a damaged mail ballot. So they may have made a mistake on their mail ballot, their dog may have ate it, their kid may have drawn over it, all over it. One of those various reasons that someone may have a damaged mail ballot, they show up, they come to the service center. And sort of this was the first point in the process that we had a lot of discussion amongst the counties on what makes sense for all of these different scenarios that a voter may show up and need to fill out a form. The first line doesn't, it's pretty straightforward, it's just depositing a mail ballot. The rest of them all involve some sort of form or some sort of interaction with the computer. So the way it's laid out here is more consistent with the way that we currently do it, or we previously did it in our early voting module, but there is some discussion as to if it makes sense for the voter to come into the doorway and be greeted with a form to fill out, or if it makes sense for them to go up to the computer first, hand their ID, and then let the judge determine if they need to fill out a form. So we'll probably be discussing that more this week and then coming with some sort of proposal. But as this is, they come into the service center, they'll either be given a form directly to fill out, or they'll approach the counter first, and then it'll be determined if they need to complete a form. The one consistent message that we heard on the call on Wednesday, and that actually is consistent with the way that Denver has done things over the past few years, along with a couple other counties, is to have a combo form. So if they need to register to vote, if they need to change their address, if they need to get a replacement ballot, whatever their reason is for being there, they have one form, the voter fills it out, and that form can handle all of the different scenarios that a voter may be there. And what this does is it lessens the confusion amongst election judges to have to pull out the correct form. Currently, there's a change of address form, there's an emergency registration form, there's a change of a party affiliation form, there's a correction of party affiliation form, there's a voter assistance form. So there's literally seven or eight different forms that a voter may fill out at a location. And definitely the message that the counties would like to see is a combination form. Everything can be taken care of on that form. And it should be fairly easy to do. We proposed a form to use starting in 2010 in Denver that is a combination form. The state approved that form. A few other counties have utilized that since. And really what it does is it, we're all the same information is really appearing on all the forms. It's just different fields, possibly they're on different forms. So if we can get a combo form, and that's what this flowchart is based on as we go through this. So that's a big point that came from the counties, and hopefully it'll make it easier from a training perspective and then also from the voter's perspective. So back to the flowchart, a registered voter with a damaged ballot, they'll approach the counter, they'll fill out their combo form, and then they would surrender their damaged ballot if they have it. And any components of that. So one of the things we also talked about was making sure that we, if they want to take the ballot with them, so if they want to take it out and carry it home, they would get a completely new packet. Or if they don't want to take the ballot with them, they will vote a flat ballot, so just a flat ballot, not a mail ballot, and or a DRE. So they have the choice to get those two things at a service center. They'd be issued either a mail ballot packet to take home or a flat ballot or the DRE, obviously, and then they would place their voted ballot in one of the ballot boxes or submit their vote on the DRE ballot. So you'll see that same consistent process all the way down all of these different swim lanes with a couple variations. So if they are a voter who would like to vote on an ADA accessible machine, similar process, but obviously they would be issued a DRE voting card and they wouldn't have a choice if they're saying up front that they want to vote on the machine. And then an unregistered voter, which is the fifth box down, same thing, they'd fill out a combo form and then they'd have one of those options. They can take a mail ballot packet with them, they can vote a flat paper ballot, or they can vote on a DRE. And an analogy that came up actually from one of my staff members when we were talking about this is dine in or carry out. So the way the bill's laid out, if you're carrying out, you're taking a mail ballot packet, you're going to take it home, you want to look at it further, and then you'll drop it off or mail it back. If you're dining in, you'll get a flat ballot or a DRE, one of the two. So kind of a good way to look at it, hopefully less confusing to the voters that way. And then finally, provisional ballots. So while 1303 significantly reduces the number of ways that a voter may end up on a provisional, there are still going to be some need and some reasons for a voter voting a provisional ballot. And the bottom process, the blue part, shows what happens at a service center while the voter's there. And then the sort of orange part shows what happens after the election and how that provisional is therefore verified after the election. So some of the reasons that a voter may vote a provisional ballot: they don't have proper ID, they didn't meet residency requirements, they're successfully challenged, or if they've already cast a ballot. So when we go to look up and score, if they've already returned a mail ballot or voted somewhere else, we would know that, and they would be issued a provisional ballot immediately. So that's kind of the sort of the overview, and obviously you can see there's a lot of similarities in how things are going to be processed, but we thought this was good to sort of lay out why a voter may come to the site and then what process they would go through when they get there. So with that, any questions from the commissioners on any of this?
Great job. It's pretty impressive. Any questions for either Amber or Hillary? Pretty good. We're looking forward to more.
Okay.
Thank
you. Would ask the committee. Oh, go ahead.
Sort of a preview. What do we see next week?
So many options. We'll decide when we decide the agenda. We'll see a next level. This is from the voter experience. As you can tell, so the where it interacts with SCORE is that middle desk after the combo form. So we'll show a little closer of like what happens during that interaction with a bit more of flowchart process on that. And then in addition to that, we were asked to show you the work that the previous SCORE advisory board had done, some backup documentation. We'll send that out ahead of time. So we'll be prepared to answer any questions on any of that. And then I had a question for you all is what other information would be helpful? Again, we're trying to help give a little more of the picture of what is going to actually, what we currently do and what is going to happen with this new bill. It seems like helping to create what's the similarities and what's different is where we were thinking to focus our attention, but I wanted direction from you all too, just to make sure we're prepared with the questions that would be helpful.
This is Cindy Agri. I would like to see how the counties currently utilize election judges and what their interaction with the process going to be under the new law.
And with that, just to ask a clarifying question, we have the early voting judges and the election day, and then we also have with polling place, and then we have vote center judges. And so all of those, or because polling place judges there won't really be any applicable, but do you want us to just answer that question?
I think it would be helpful so okay. That we can address the training issue.
Okay.
Please, thank you.
Thanks. I just wanted to make sure we didn't give you more than you wanted. All right.
So do you anticipate that the voter experience is going to be the same across counties? Because I see in the model you have, the choice of either getting the mail ballot or voting what you refer to as the flat ballot. Is every county going to have a flat ballot, or are some counties only going to have the mail ballot, or do we know?
So we will answer. There are a few more choice points at the county level, and that's what next week's diagram will show more of. The quick answer with that is there has to be in-person voting, and the way we currently read it is that could just be DRE, or if you wanted a paper ballot, you could be issued a mail ballot, and I believe there are some counties that's their current intention on that.
Is to issue a mail ballot?
If they want to vote paper, and if they want to vote in person, they would vote on the DRE.
So in the case that they would be issued a mail ballot, there would be no ID check because it would just be a mail ballot that they would walk out off with, or that they would
depends on who they would be from. We'll show that in the next chart.
Okay.
I'd rather have the visual
than
have you go through that.
Yeah.
But yes,
I would just like to know if there are going to be counties that are only going to offer the mail ballot. Does that mean that those counties will necessarily then not be requesting any type of ID because we'll just be voting a mail ballot? I mean, whether or not you vote it right there at the desk or walk outside and vote it in your car and come back seems not very relevant to me. Right. If you have a mail ballot, you have a mail ballot.
Yeah, and that's so, one of the issues that we've asked also with Michael Hegel-Harris is on the phone. So we want to continue looking at that. What are the options? But the way current law reads.
And the other thing that came up with that, Suzanne, to your point, is if we issue if someone comes in person, they get a mail ballot, and then their signature doesn't match later, and then they get a rejection letter that their signature didn't match, even though they were standing there in person, that's not going to be a good experience for the voter if, you know, they kind of did that in person. So that definitely came up. And then you also, you're almost having to spend more time on that voter because they were there in person. Why would you issue a mail if you have flat ballot stock anyways? Because then you have to then verify their signature on the back end, so you're touching it again. So it didn't really seem to make sense from a process perspective that that you would do that, because if you have the paper stock, your paper stock for mail could be the same as your paper stock for in person. So it seems to make sense if they're standing there in front of you and they've got all their ID and they're good to go, give them a flat ballot so then it can just be processed immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I would think so too. I guess my concern when you say, you know, not a very good experience for the voter, I mean, there either has to be the utility bill or, you know, whatever ID, or there's got to be a signature check.
Right.
I mean, you can't walk out the door with a mail ballot and then say, well, you picked it up in person, so, you know, you bypass any verification.
Yeah, and that's, like, on here where so voter does not have proper ID, that would go to, just like it does now, go to a provisional if they were there in person wanting to do that, and they couldn't meet the identification requirements. So
I guess I just want to make sure that person can't then get a mail ballot, walk out to their car, fill it out, and then drop it off without a signature.
Without a signature?
Right.
No.
I mean, I'm just saying it's got to be one or the other.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And the other decision point that isn't reflected on here that you'll see next week, too, is the use of ballot-on-demand printers. So some counties are planning to have ballot-on-demand printers, and they'll just print their paper stock as voters come in. We're not going to do that because that would cost us a lot of money to put out the number of printers, so we're going to have stock. So some counties are going to be printing, and other counties are going to have stock, and so there's some variations there, which you'll see on the flowcharts next week. And the flowchart, this one's sort of a high-level swim lane, if you will, and then the one next week, to answer your question, is more of a decision point flowchart, so it kind of shows some yeses and nos and things like that. So, okay.
Elena. So to go back to your question, Hillary, but other things that would be helpful, I think it would be helpful to show how ballots are processed on the back end. So once they leave the voter service and polling center and they go back to the clerk's office, what that looks like. And I think some of the counties already have. I mean, it's an existing process, so it's not as new as I think maybe this is, but showing that I think would be helpful for us as well.
I would say we probably could do that for a different meeting because there's multiple systems, and so. But that could be arranged with this group, but we'll add that onto the list. So we focused more on the interaction with SCORE and the programming and the implementation report.
And I don't think it's time sensitive, just as background, and seeing how different counties do it too might be helpful as well, because that's something that, since it's existing, it's not a... The best practice may vary depending on the county.
Great. Bob?
We talked about a process of posting these... processes and having the counties review them and buy in. Might be interesting to, if we can, find out where they intend to deviate. Like, you know, the issue of are they going to use mail ballots or flat ballots? I mean, you know, all those questions. If we had some sense of how much variation we had over the counties, I think it'd be pretty interesting.
Okay. I know there's this, it's the chicken and the egg, also looking at what rules get implemented to finalize. And, and so, but we will... We'll tell you what we know so far. Counties haven't actually committed. We're just at this phase, even on the phone call, it was more things that they were considering. And I think that would be also a good place for the commission to weigh in too on what they think. And so, again, that balancing act of how we make the process
and
final.
To that point too, we are, the Clerks Association has what they call an ESRC committee that reviews statute and rules when new things come out. And so we have a meeting scheduled this Wednesday, and this is on the agenda to walk through and get feedback from all the counties that participate in that call, which is usually about 40 to 50 folks, so we're going to do that as well.
Dan, can you share that with us, that feedback?
Yeah, that's going to be, you know, we'll talk about this, and then their feedback will feed into the process that we'll present for next week. So likely you're going to have a lot of feedback from various counties for next week.
And related to that, we have a call scheduled with the group on Thursday to get ready, take that information, get ready and for the meeting on Monday with you all. So if there's anything else that comes up between now and then, of course, copy the group, but let us know whether that would be.
Okay. Elena.
And to that end, I think we also talked last week about posting this with the materials so that if members of the public had any input on from a voter's perspective what it looked like, they could weigh into the commission as well.
Thank you.
That would be great.
So if both Amber and Hillary can tell the business practices subgroup that thank you for the work, and we look forward to next weekend working with them.
Great.
So now we have the NCOA filters. Hillary, are you going to come do?
Hi, good afternoon. It's my understanding of the last meeting that some questions came up in terms of how we're going to handle NCOA checks, given 1303. Is that a little better?
Oh, well, that's better. Sorry, Hillary Rudy with the Elections Division. It's my understanding in the meeting last week some questions came up with regards to how we're going to handle the NCOA checks, the National Change of Address Verification, in line with 1303. We have previously done an NCOA check on a quarterly basis and published it out to the counties, but in reviewing 1303 and some of the best practices among the larger jurisdictions that currently do this on an ongoing basis, particularly Denver County, we've reevaluated our current NCOA check. We are completely changing the process, and in fact, we're in the process of changing vendors as well, as we believe our existing vendor is not going to provide the information that we need in a timely and accurate manner. So what we're looking at doing is for the NCOA checks beginning this month, we will provide an export to our vendor. We'll get an export back that includes residential, as well as mailing at ZIP plus 4. So that will give the counties both residential and mailing information. I think that was one particular point of concern from the larger counties that currently conduct NCOA checks on their own. In addition, we've worked with counties in terms of the ZIP plus 4 issue because we learned in implementation of a new postal requirement this last several months, intelligent mail barcode, that many of our addresses in the current address library don't include the ZIP plus 4, and counties do need that information in order to implement the intelligent mail barcode requirements. So we're going to be gathering the plus 4 for all of the addresses currently in the address library on a one-time basis, and then counties will maintain that moving forward. So we're working on doing both of those exports for the July mailing. As I mentioned, we are changing vendors, so there's been a little bit of a delay as we implement the vendor change, but what we anticipate at this point with the new vendor, which is actually the same vendor that Denver County currently uses, is that we'll have a one business day turnaround when we provide them the data. So while our July export will come by the 25th of the month, we anticipate adjusting that timeline as we move forward and providing that earlier in the month moving forward. So beginning this month, we'll provide that monthly to the FTP site for counties to access. And that's the plan. You guys have questions?
Jesse.
Thank you. So when you say July 25th of this next one, does that mean the information coming from you or going to the vendor? I know you just said a one-day turnaround time, but...
Actually, July 25th is the deadline that we will provide the information out to the counties.
So then when... Okay, thank you. I guess my question is, when are you providing your data to the vendor?
I don't know when we're providing the data to the vendor yet, but we'll provide the data to the counties no later than July 25th.
Can you just remind me, I know the inactive failed to votes will be updated. I can't remember who was the one that just happened this weekend, it's before that. I just wanted to confirm.
It is before that. Yeah, the inactive failed to vote will be converted to active before we do that first data set, so it will be included.
I just remember the dates. Thank you.
And if we pull our data before we implement that in SCORE, we'll make sure that we include those in the data pool. We intend to include those.
Any other questions for Hillary? Jesse.
Thanks again. Last week we were told that we might have some sense of how you intend to set the filters. Are you prepared to go over that, or will there be subsequent documents, or can you comment on that?
What do you mean by setting the filters?
I mean that there's dependent on the vendors, and I'm not the one who processes this technically, but you can determine how specific you want addresses and individuals caught, whether it's a high level of sensitivity, mid-level, that kind of thing, or if it's a broader net cast. And we were, Judd mentioned that he would be able to review that with us and that we would be able to have some kind of comment on that, whether it's this week or not. The reason I asked it to be on the agenda this week is because I anticipated the first match being fairly important, since it was the first time you were exporting this kind of information to the counties.
Well, it's not the first time we're exporting this information to the counties. As I mentioned, we've been doing this on a quarterly basis. It's the first time we're exporting the information, to this level of detail. So what we're going to be pulling from our address library is a full voter registration file that includes residential and mailing address. We'll be exporting that to the vendor. We'll be asking the vendor to do a cast check, which is a verification that the addresses we've provided are mailable, and also include a return of zip plus 4 for every address that does not include it for both residential and mailing. We'll also be asking the vendor to provide back any changes to either residential or mailing. All names, all addresses will be fully parsed, and we will be providing back to the counties one file that includes all address changes within the county that will include a distinction between residential and mailing. We'll include a file, it may be the same file with a different tab, but a file that includes all address changes within the state but outside of the county, and the third that includes all address changes outside of the state. And that's important because of the three aspects of the NCOA check in 1303. It requires a different process for each of those. So in terms of the filters, what we'll be filtering is we'll filter into one set any address changes, both for residential and mailing addresses, and with the distinguishing flag within county, a separate filter for within the state but outside of the county, and the third for all address changes outside of the state. And again, we'll provide for each of those residential and mailing. The fourth file that we'll be working with internally is the zip plus four file. And so for any addresses that have no changes, what we'll be doing is we'll work with the score development team to upload the zip plus 4 to each of those. So we won't upload the zip plus 4 for any address, residential or mailing, that's changed, only for those that show no changes. Does that answer your question?
I was more concerned about some specifics, but I'm going to have to just, if today is the only day that we're going to get to have feedback on this,
it would be helpful if you could tell me what specifics you're looking for. I mean, we're not going to be doing much more filtering than that. It's up to the counties then to process this data. But if there are some specifics that you're looking for, I'd be happy to get the information for you.
Good. Any other questions? Great. Thank you, Hillary.
You might want to read this.
And so I think our only other item that we have left is our agenda for the next week. And I know, Suzanne, you said you're not going to be here. Is that right?
Yeah, I won't be here. I will call in.
Steve, what do you have down at this point that we were going to?
So we're going to discuss the draft report and finalize it for Freeman Craft McGregor. That's the big one. And then the business practices subgroup report. Those are the two items that I have so far.
Great. I think that does sound doable. Oh, Bob.
Mm-hmm. I have asked for a review of the security policy at some future meeting. It doesn't have to be next week, but
to let that go? Okay. Would that be, I'm wondering if we can, our meetings are scheduled 1 to 4, have those two and feel like we have adequately, but put that on and then feel comfortable to move it to the next
And that also reminds us, it's a reminder to me that we want to discuss that, but don't feel totally committed or that if it doesn't get addressed based on the two. Okay, does that sound good? All righty. So there'll be a couple phone calls.
On the security, I would just ask, and maybe others are clear, who's providing what, and what is it that, is it what's in rule already? Is it what's included in the security plan, and who's...
Bob, you want to refresh us?
There's an paragraph in the craft report that says that, you know, we need a review of the security policy for the system. We talked about it in the last session. It has to do with the boundary between a lot of new equipment, county level, you know, a lot of things to talk. But when I went back and looked at the fiscal note, I don't see any resources in there to address security at all. And so my question was, who's doing that? And we left it in the report that is required. My point of view is definitely a piece of work, and we had it coming from that community. So my question was, who's doing it? And if it's a new effort that hasn't already been accomplished, why don't we have it in the fiscal note? So that's where I was coming from. And I said, well, come tell us about it. Because, you know, our staff said, oh, well, we've only got that well in hand.
And Bob, I volunteered at the last meeting to try to follow that up, and we just had a lot of people on vacation last week. But my feeling is that the counties all have security policies in place for their users, and they're already accessing a lot of state systems. Last week we talked about the CBMS system, but the county clerks also use our driver's license and automotive registration systems. So they likely had to pass some sort of inspection or audit at that point anyway. And I would suspect that the same would apply in this case, but I'm still in the process of getting more detailed information for you. So I think next Monday is fine.
Well, I mean, if it's a settled issue, it should not be in the craft report. It says in that report, we're submitting it to the legislature that we need to assess the security of the voting environment. So we're either going to do it or we aren't. That's my point.
Right.
And I'd like to hear more about it.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and put it on the agenda for
a couple weeks.
Okay.
That's fine.
Great. All right, that works. Okay. Great. All right, is there anything else?
So just so I'm clear, the security policy is going on the agenda for the 22nd?
Okay. 2 weeks out. Thank you, Steve. Anything else? Okay. I guess we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.